Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's date is Thursday the 28th of October 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is the first episode in a mini-series on Carl Pearson, a great mathematician and eugenicist. And of course, my co-host for today is Max Musson from Western Spring. All right, well, should we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max? We finished with the immigration conversation for today?
I think we have, yes. Let's move on.
Yeah, let's get into talking about Carl Pearson, a particular favourite of yours. We're going to be talking about a scientific Greatest Briton today. Do you want to just tell us in particular why you think Carl Pearson should be one of our Greatest Britons, Max?
Well, Carl Pearson is a polymath. That is somebody who has achieved a high level of study and competence in a range of different subjects. He's not just become a specialist in one particular field. He's known best as being a mathematician and a biostatistician. But he was a protege of Sir Francis Galton that we've covered before in the Greatest Britons. And he's just an outstanding scholar, an outstanding scientist. He's studied maths at Cambridge. He studied physics at Heidelberg University. He studied metaphysics, physiology, Roman law, 16th century German literature, English law, and socialism, which is one of the things that first caught my eye. Carl Pearson came to know of Carl Pearson through a pamphlet that had been written at the time, which basically was the text of a speech that he'd made back in 1900. This was a speech he'd made to, I think, somewhere in Newcastle. I'm not quite sure what the venue was, but this speech was entitled "National Life from the Standpoint of Science," because Carl Pearson was a racialist. He believed in the importance of race, and that he felt that race is an important factor in all of human affairs. He was also a eugenicist. And he was a scientific nationalist, and so he believed in applying the findings of science to making the nation stronger. And at the same time, he was a socialist, and if you read another speech that he made, which is called Socialism in Theory and Practice, it could have almost been written by Robert Blatchford that we've just finished covering, because it was the issues that Carl Pearson raises are exactly the same issues that Robert Blatchford raises in his writings in Merry England and Britain for the British. And so Carl Pearson, in combining nationalism and socialism in what he called scientific nationalism, he was back in the late 1800s, because he wrote some of these, he started writing about these things in about 1884, I think it was, and so he was a homegrown national socialist that predates anything that occurred on the continent of Europe 50 years or so later.
So he was a genius, somebody that we can all look up to, basically, that set standards and broke records and discovered new things and basically laid the foundations for a lot of the science that gets discussed today. Well, Carl Pearson was born on the 27th of March, 1857, and he died the 27th of April, 1936. And he was an English mathematician and a biostatistician. And biostatistics is the development and application of statistical methods to a wide range of topics. In biology, it encompasses the design of biological experiments, the collection and analysis of data from those experiments, and the interpretation of the results. And I would guess that's where his understanding of race came from, because if this was the first time that you were collecting measurements of people, measuring their bone structure, their proportions, and then collating it all together and looking at groups rather than looking at individuals. This was the first time that it was possible to be done, and he was the first person to do this, to think of biostatistics, to take all these statistics of biological measurements and then have a look at them and see what the averages are and see what the differences are between people. So he was the father of biostatistics. You know much about biostatistics, Max?
I would say not an incredible amount. I mean, in this respect, Carl Pearson was continuing the work of Sir Francis Galton. And so some of the things that Carl Pearson worked on were inspired by Sir Francis Galton. Some of the things that Carl Pearson looked into, it was using statistics in order to determine whether there is a valid conclusion that can be drawn from that body of statistics, basically. And what I would say is that virtually anybody who's been to university and who studied a science at university will, for their dissertation, have needed to create a statistical analysis to determine whether or not the outcome that they identified in their dissertation was statistically valid. And the mathematics that they would have used in order to do that would have been developed by Sir Francis Galton and by Carl Pearson subsequently. And so, people who go to university nowadays and who become very woke as a result of that may shrink back in horror at the thought that they're actually using techniques developed by somebody like Carl Pearson. But in fact, they are. And so that's something for them to contemplate. There are some interesting things that Carl Pearson did. One of the things that stuck in my mind from when I first started reading about him was the fact that he measured the heights of people in prison. And he didn't just do this so that he could determine how tall the average criminal is. He measured the heights of criminals over a period of decades and established the rate at which people's height diminishes as they get older. And this can then be used in various lines of endeavour that are intended to bring relief to people who are perhaps suffering in old age and that sort of thing. But one of the things that he determined was that the average person from their prime at the age of 30 will lose an inch in height by the time they reach age 60. And then on average, they will then lose a further inch in height for every decade they live beyond age 60. Which I think is quite an interesting thing. And that's why, there's the origin of the phrase, the little old lady and the little old man that people talk about. This little old lady came down the street, this little old man came down the street or whatever. And it is a provable fact that people get a bit smaller as they get older. And that's why you do tend to see lots of old ladies and old men who are on average shorter than the youthful population. That's just because they have shrunk slightly as time's gone by.
So he proved that that wasn't just something that you saw, that was something that could be measured, and that was something that was universal. So I guess he was in the business of dispelling superstition. And if you can collect statistics like that, from the conclusions that you reach, you can make predictions as well. So it would have been very useful. Well, he has been credited with establishing the discipline of mathematical statistics, which is the application of probability theory. So that there we have it. If something is likely to happen, you can work that out from the statistics, whether or not something is going to happen. The probability of it occurring comes from these statistics. He founded the world's first university statistics department at University College London in 1911 and contributed significantly to the field of biometrics and meteorology. So again, he was interested in the weather, the same as Francis Galton. Pearson was also a proponent of social Darwinism, eugenics, and Wikipedia tells us, scientific racism. And I thought I'd look up their description of scientific racism, because I've got a few points I'd like to make on this. And they say scientific racism, sometimes termed biological racism, is the pseudo-scientific belief that empirical evidence exists to support or justify racism, which means racial discrimination, racial inferiority, or racial superiority. Historically, scientific racism received credence throughout the scientific community, but it is no longer considered scientific. And I answer that by saying, well, racism isn't scientific, but differences between the races are certainly proved by science. Dividing humankind into biologically distinct groups is sometimes called racialism, race realism, or race science by its proponents. Modern scientific consensus rejects this view as being irreconcilable with modern genetic research. And that's what Wikipedia says there. They say that the scientific consensus rejects this view. Well, no, the scientific consensus rejects racism, but not the fact that the races are different. We can see observably they are different. The statistics show that they are different. And what they're doing is they're being very disingenuous here. They're trying to discredit all the research you did by calling it racism. He may have been racist, but the research that he did, if it hasn't been proved to be false, then it was true. The mainstream media basically tries to claim that this research is irreconcilable with modern genetic research, but the only really way you could prove these scientists wrong in their results would be to find a different result, yet the results are consistent across the board. There are differences between the races. Whether you use those facts to support racism or not is the point. And perhaps these early scientists did, because that was the time they lived in, but that does not negate their statistics. And their statistics is what Wikipedia is trying to pretend here have been discredited because the people that discovered the statistics were racist. Well, facts can't be racist. Only the people using them can be. And that depends entirely on what they are using the facts for. So this scientific racism, saying he's a proponent of scientific racism, that's just an attempt to smear him. I mean, what they should really have said is that he was a proponent of biostatistics and he measured the differences between the races, and he showed that there were differences between them. But then, unfortunately, he decided to go into some races are superior to other races. And, you know, as I've spoken about before, what is the benchmark that you are going to have for that? You know, it's like saying humpback whales are superior to blue whales. Well, they're not. They're a completely different kettle of fish. So when you're talking about races, races are different to one another. You cannot say that one is superior to another because you have no benchmark for it, because the only benchmark you have is your own race. So it's an impossible question to answer. And that's what racism is. It's an impossible question to answer. That's not what we deal with here, and that's not really what these scientists were dealing with. They discovered facts. It's the way that you use the facts that determines whether somebody is being racist or not. So Wikipedia is just trying to smear all of this and saying that it's scientific racism. And you know, I think I've just shown that what the facts aren't the scientific racism. It's just the way that they use that is important here. What yes. do you think of that, Max?
Yes, I would agree with what you're saying there. In terms of superiority or not, I think that you can say that one particular race on average is superior at a particular task, but then another race on average might be superior at a different task. And if one racial group has a culture which does not value scientific endeavor, for example, then they will not develop their scientific knowledge, and so therefore their scientific knowledge will be inferior to a race that does value scientific knowledge and scientific endeavor. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the race that didn't develop that didn't engage in scientific endeavor is inferior to the race that did. It just means that they have got no interest in it.
Yeah, that's the benchmark. That's when you actually come up with a benchmark, then you can do these measurements. But you cannot just say one race is inferior and another race is superior. And that was that. You know, that is the allegation that they are making here is that that's what these people did. Maybe that is what they did. That was the time that they lived in. But it doesn't disprove all those measurements that they did and all those statistics that they collated. Well, Pearson was also a protege and a biographer of Sir Francis Galton. He edited and completed both William Kingdon Clifford's Common Sense of the Exact Sciences in 1885 and Isaac Toadhunter's History of the Theory of Elasticity, Volume 1, 1886 to 1893, and Volume 2, 1893 following their deaths. Now, they brought this up, so they're obviously quite important books, but I haven't heard of them before. Have you heard of these books before, Max?
No, I haven't heard of those before, no. I'm not sure what they contain. I have read some of Carl Pearson's work, but I wouldn't say that I've read even the majority of it, to be quite honest, because he wrote so many papers on so many subjects and so many books that it would take a lot of time to read everything that he's written.
Yeah, the actual number, I mean, I couldn't count them. Just countless books and articles and speeches that this man has given, and all of them scientific. Well, let's have a look at his early life here. He was born in Islington, London, into a Quaker family. So I suspect there was a lot of time that was spent in silence and studying, because the Quakers are known for silence, aren't they? I think when they have their meetings, they just sit there in silence until somebody thinks of something important to say. Do you know much about Quakers, Max?
No, other than that Quakers were they were called Quakers because they literally were believed to quake in the presence of the Lord, and they sometimes used to have bizarre names like shaking in the, Joseph shaking in the presence of the Lord, and things of that sort, which was a quaint aspect of their lives. But generally speaking, what I know of Quakers is that they have tended to work hard. The Quaker families that have tended to do well are families like the Cadburys, who tended to have a very sympathetic understanding of the needs of the people who worked for them, and who tried to uplift the people who worked for them. And as I've mentioned, I think last week, with regard to Cadburys, they created the Bourneville Village, which was an idyllic village that was intended to provide the kind of the ideal environment for people, and so they did have a great deal of care for the people in their charge. They were persecuted at some point during history, and a large number of them then went over to what is now the United States of America, and I believe there probably are more Quakers in the United States of America than there are in Britain today. But I've not really studied them in any great depth, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I know they have a very, very strong work ethic, and I think their meetings are held in silence. And it's interesting because Pearson was actually an atheist. So he was brought up in this Quaker family, but he ended up being an atheist. His father was William Pearson QC, of the Inner Temple, and his mother was Fanny Nee Smith, and he had two siblings, Arthur and Amy. So his father was a QC, so high up in the law trade. So that intelligence, that very high IQ, has been passed down to his children. Pearson has basically inherited his intelligence from his father here. That's what that says to me. Pearson attended University College School, followed by King's College, Cambridge, in 1876 to study mathematics, graduating in 1879 as third wrangler in the mathematical tripos, which meant that he got first class honours in his final year. That's what a third wrangler is. He then travelled to Germany, studying physics at the University of Heidelberg under G.H. Quink and metaphysics under Kuno Fischer. After that, he visited the University of Berlin, where he attended the lectures of the physiologist Emil Dubois-Raymond on Darwinism, and Emil was a brother of Paul Dubois-Raymond, the mathematician. Again, so you see, it runs in the family. Intelligence runs in the family. Pearson also studied Roman law, medieval and 16th century German literature, and socialism. He became an accomplished historian and Germanist, and spent much of the 1880s in Berlin, Heidelberg, and Vienna. He wrote on passion plays, religion, Goethe and Werther, as well as sex-related themes, and was a founder of the Men and Women's Club, which was a debating society for men and women to discuss relations between the sexes. I bet that was interesting. I'd like to see some of the transcripts from that, the way that men and women used to interact before the age of feminism. And I should imagine his work on passion plays and religion would have been quite critical, because he was an atheist. You got any comments you want to make on any of that, Max?
Well, the fact that there was a men and women's club which debated issues that related to the sort of interrelations of the sexes, I think that rather throws a spanner in the works as far as feminists are concerned, militant feminists nowadays who claim that men, I can remember I was listening to an episode of Woman's Hour on the radio as I was driving along a few days back, and this woman was saying there that that men in times gone by, when men dominated the publishing trade and the arts and things like this, that men didn't consider women or women's needs whatsoever. Well, the fact that there was a men and women's club, which was a debating society for men and women, where women could debate with men, actually proves that wrong, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and that was 140 years ago as well, so I don't see much oppression of women going on there. He was offered a Germanics post at King's College, Cambridge, and when comparing Cambridge students to those he knew from Germany, Karl found German students inathletic and weak. He wrote to his mother, "I used to think athletics and sport were overestimated at Cambridge, but now I think it cannot be too highly valued." And I find this interesting because when Adolf Hitler took power with the National Socialists, a big part of National Socialism was getting the youth to get involved in sport and to be athletic. And this was 60 years before then, 50 or 60 years before then. So perhaps there was a problem with the Germans. Perhaps they really didn't do very much athletics at school. And, you know, because he was obviously a fan of the Germans, he was a fan of Germanism, but he actually found that they're physically, they were rather a weak race, which surprises me. Well, in his first book, The New Werther, Pearson gives us a clear indication of why he studied so many diverse subjects. He said, "I rush from science to philosophy, and from philosophy to our old friends, the poets. And then, overwearied by too much idealism, I fancy I become practical in returning to science. Have you ever attempted to conceive all there is in the world worth knowing, that not one subject in the universe is unworthy of study? The giants of literature, the mysteries of many-dimensional space, the attempts of Boltzmann and Crookes to penetrate nature's very laboratory, the Kantian theory of the universe, and the latest discoveries in embryology, with their wonderful tales of the development of life, what an immensity beyond our grasp. Mankind seems on the verge of a new and glorious discovery. What Newton did to simplify the planetary motions must now be done to unite in one whole the various isolated theories of mathematical physics." So there's a lot there, and he's basically saying he had this zest for learning to find out everything that he possibly could about everything, and that there is nothing in the universe that is unworthy of study. And, you know, I would like to aspire to that. I like to learn about as many different things as possible. And I guess he was also, even though he was educated at these universities, he was also somewhat of an autodidact and just studying whatever it was that he could study and find out everything that he could about it, in with the aim of using these different disciplines to come to blend them together into some kind of whole, some kind of uniting theory. So if he was studying one thing, like he says here, studying philosophy, then he could use the information that he had learned about religion in philosophy, or the information that he'd learned in biology, he could use that in religion. So it's good to learn about as many different things as possible. And today, people just tend to concentrate on one thing. They will just study one thing and to the exclusion of everything else. Whereas I think back then, you were given a much more rounded education, and you could learn about all these different things, because there wasn't so much information there in these disciplines that there is now. You got so much information in one small part of medicine today, that you need to just study that one part of it to learn all there is to do with it. But back then, when there wasn't that much information about, when we didn't have the internet, you would study the classics, you would study classic civilization and get up to speed on everything that had got us up to that point today, and then you could look into everything, because there wasn't that much information there. Today we've got information overload, but I still think it's the best way to be, is to study everything you can and try to find out everything that you can about everything. Well, what do you think of his indication here for why he studied so many diverse subjects, Max.
Yeah, I agree with what you were saying, actually. And I think that one of the things that happened in the past, because we didn't have computers and the internet, was that people, if they wanted to become a polymath in the way that Carl Pearson did, then they would need to rely solely upon their brain power to actually remember all the things and to hold all the various theories and notions, etc., that they had in their head. And from a from an evolutionary perspective, we've created books. And books then meant that people didn't have to carry everything in their head. They could carry a book around and refer to the book instead of remembering the information. And now we've got the internet. People don't have to carry books around. They can just Google something on the internet. It's quite right what you say, that with certain scientific subjects now, they're far more detailed, that there's a lot more for people to actually know. But I agree with you that it is still a good discipline to try and learn as much as you can, because that proves your worth, because as a human, because in comparison with somebody who relies on the internet, if there's a power cut or the internet goes down for any reason, then that person no longer has access to all the information that's held on the internet. If there is some kind of apocalyptic event that happens in the future, and both the internet and the vast libraries that currently exist are destroyed, then again, those people who've been able to hold a lot of information in their heads, people who've become polymaths, will be exceedingly valuable people. You know, the old saying, in the land of the blind, a one-eyed man is king, and the same would be true in a post-apocalyptic world where libraries and the internet have gone down.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, if you've studied one discipline, you can apply the knowledge that you got in that discipline to another discipline, and you can look at it from a different point of view. And I should imagine that they would also study mnemonics before they had books, and even when they did have books. I mean, at this time, they would learn stuff by memory so that they could repeat speeches from memory and things like that, and learn different mnemonic tricks so that you could remember long lengths of text and repeat them. And of course, all of that is just forgotten today. I can remember at school learning to do plays and learning my lines and thinking how difficult it was to do that. And yet people would remember whole poems off by heart years ago. They would challenge the mind all the time. And they probably didn't have so many problems with dementia as we do now.
Yes.
You know, they say that, don't they? The more crosswords you do, the less likely you are to get dementia, because you're challenging the mind. And, you know, we concentrate,
that's right.
We concentrate so much on physical, being strong physically and working in the gym, and yet people aren't challenging the mind anymore because they just Google everything.
That's right. Widely believe now in medicine that if you in older age decide to learn a new language, or decide to learn how to play a musical instrument, or take up a new skill and learn to become proficient in a new skill, some form of handicraft or whatever, metalworking, woodworking, basketry, or embroidery, all these kind of things, they stimulate the brain and seem to stave off Alzheimer's and dementia and things of that sort.
I think it's because the brain is quite plastic, isn't it? And when you're learning new things, it develops in new ways. So you go through one discipline and your brain is shaped one way, and then you start learning another discipline and your brain gets shaped another way. And it's because your brain is plastic, and it sort of grows with the memories, with the new memories. So it's constantly keeping it active, basically, so that it doesn't go to sleep. Well, his next move was to return to London to study law, emulating his father. And quoting from his own account, he said, "Coming to London, I read in chambers in Lincoln's Inn, drew up bills of sale, and was called to the bar. But varied legal studies by lecturing on Heat at Barnes, on Martin Luther at Hampstead, and on Lassalle and Marx on Sundays at revolutionary clubs, around Soho. So he got very interested in learning all about the legal side of things. And this is after doing the scientific stuff. And his next career move was to the Inner Temple, the same as his father, where he read law until 1881, although he never practiced it. After this, he returned to mathematics, deputising for the mathematics professor at King's College London in 1881 and for the professor at University College London in 1883. In 1884, he was appointed to the Goldschmidt Chair of Applied Mathematics and Mechanics at University College London. Pearson became the editor of Common Sense of the Exact Sciences in 1885 when William Kingdon Clifford died, and in 1890 he married Maria Sharp. The couple had three children, Sigrid Letitia Pearson, Helga Sharp Pearson, and Egon Pearson, who became a statistician himself and succeeded his father as head of the Applied Statistics Department at University College. So we see there the intelligence passes down from the grandfather to the father to the son. It's hereditary. IQ is hereditary. Intelligence is hereditary. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
No. I think you've explained that pretty well. That were the sort of comments I would have made, that intelligence, I believe, is hereditary.
And interesting that his daughters didn't appear to follow him into anything. They appear to have become loyal wives, housewives, but his son became a statistician and succeeded his father as the head of the...
One of Pearson's beliefs that he sort of wrote about in National Life from the Standpoint of Science, or which he spoke, because that was a speech, was that it was a duty for middle-class people to have children so that they could increase the average intelligence of their nation. And he points to the fact that during the period that he was alive and prior to that, and also subsequent to that, the opposite has been happening, where middle class people have tended to have fewer children and have limited their family size in order that they can send their children to the best schools, etc. Whereas Pearson's the point that Pearson made quite strongly was that it would be better to have had more children and for those children to have had a lower position in society initially than for those children never to have existed at all.
That would have been better for society, wouldn't it? But of course that's getting rather close to eugenics. Shall we get into Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Carl Pearson. We began this series last week and we talked about how he came from a very intelligent Quaker family and went on to have very intelligent children, how he was the first to use statistics in a mathematical way in order to make predictions, particularly with regards to biology and race. A lot of his work is now called scientific racism, and this is an attempt to smear his discoveries by attacking the man himself. The results of his investigations are not discredited, merely the use that the scientists of the day found for them. Rather than saying one race was statistically better at one particular thing than another race, they simply claimed that one race was superior to another. He was a polymath and a genius, studying as many different subjects that he could find and applying the knowledge he accumulated across many different fields. He was offered posts at many prestigious universities, and he was seen as the heir to Sir Francis Galton, which we will talk about a little bit more today. Is there anything you want to add to that, Max?
No, that's a pretty good summary, I think, of Carl Pearson, yes.
Well, 1891 saw him also be appointed to the professorship of geometry at Gresham College, and here he met Walter Frank Raphael Weldon, a zoologist who had some interesting problems requiring quantitative solutions. This collaboration in biometry and evolutionary theory was a fruitful one and lasted until Weldon died in 1906. And Weldon introduced Pearson to Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, who was interested in aspects of evolution such as heredity and eugenics. And Pearson became Galton's protege, and Galton became almost like a hero to him. After Galton's death in 1911, Pearson embarked on producing his definitive biography, that's of Galton, a three-volume tome of narrative, letters, genealogies, commentaries, and photographs published in 1914, 1924, and 1930, with much of Pearson's own money paying for their print runs. The biography being done to satisfy myself and without regards to traditional standards, to the needs of publishers, or to the tastes of the reading public, and that's a quote from him there, triumphed Galton's life, work, and personal heredity. He predicted that Galton, rather than Charles Darwin, would be remembered as the most prodigious grandson of Erasmus Darwin. When Galton actually died, he left the residue of his estate to the University of London for a chair in eugenics, and Pearson was the first holder of this chair, the Galton Chair of Eugenics, later called the Galton Chair of Genetics, in accordance with Galton's wishes. He then formed the Department of Applied Statistics, into which he incorporated the Biometric and Galton Laboratories, and he remained with the department until his retirement in 1933, and continued to work right up until his death at Cold Harbour, Surrey, on 27th of April, 1936. So he was very involved with Francis Galton, very interested in eugenics and heredity. And it's a shame that this chair got changed to genetics. It's just a great shame that eugenics fell from grace, really. And Galton really was a fantastic guy. I mean, I lean more towards him than Charles Darwin myself. But you know more about these people, Max. You've read some of their work, haven't you? Both Galton and Pearson. What do you know about his relationship with Galton?
Well, I think that he obviously did have a very close relationship with Galton, and it appeared that during that period of history that there were quite a large number of people who had similar ideas and who were polymaths, who enjoyed each other's company and who worked in a similar way, and who were, I suppose, the advocates of social Darwinism, the application of the theories of heredity, and evolution to national life. And it's just such a great shame that. That firstly, the political situation in this country and probably around the world in general turned against them as a result of the Second World War, and so that the investigations into eugenics have been largely abandoned. Although to some extent there are some signs that scientists are now realizing that that lots of human characteristics are genetically determined, and it's only going to be a matter of time before sufficient numbers of them realize that the clusters of genetic information that exist roughly correspond with the races of mankind, and that and before they realize that race isn't a social construct, it is a natural thing. As far as these two characters were concerned, though, Galton and Pearson, they're two people who devoted their lives to investigation in these areas, and it is such a shame that even the institutes that they created in order to carry on their work have, as a result of their charitable status, had their focus diffused. And so instead of there being a chair for eugenics, it's now a chair for genetics. And what's happened and it's not just with regard to Galton and Pearson that this happened. It's happened to quite a number of scientists that were similarly minded to themselves, that the institutes that they founded and they left behind have, as a result of pressure applied to them by the Charities Commission, they have become more democratic and more and have as a result of that lost the determined and focused target of their investigation, and have been broadened into a study of genetics generally, and where the leadership of these institutes has been taken over by people whose views and whose aims in life are diametrically opposed in many cases to those of Galton and Pearson.
It's all about genetically modifying organisms now synthetically rather than through selective breeding, which was basically yes. eugenics. And they do have some eugenics programs. We seem to have less people with Down syndrome now, and they screen people when they're pregnant. But at the same time, we have so many other dysgenic policies which reward people that don't really give that much to the nation, that aren't really of much benefit to the nation. It's the people that remain on benefits all their life, and they have lots and lots of children, or people that have multi-generational criminals in their family that have lots and lots of children, and they're rewarded with the benefit system, basically. And the idea of eugenics was that the people that were most likely to be able to contribute to everybody else would be given rewards for that. And the people that were not likely to produce people that were going to be of much benefit to everyone else were encouraged to not have children, basically. Just encouraged, not forced to, but just have policies that would encourage the best people to breed, and the least best people, I guess, if we can call them that, best and not best. I mean, there's probably a better way to describe it, but to encourage them not to breed. That's basically what you do with animal husbandry, and it's what you do with plants as well. It's what you do with pedigree breeds. It's just, you know, something that we've done for thousands of years. We just seem to think that it's wrong to do it with humans for some reason, which goes back to the Second World War. Well, there was another famous person that Pearson was involved with, and that's Albert Einstein. When the 23-year-old Albert Einstein started the Olympia Academy Study Group in 1902 with his two younger friends, Maurice Solovine and Conrad Habicht, his first reading suggestion was Pearson's The Grammar of Science. This book covered several themes that were later to become part of the theories of Einstein and other scientists, such as the relativity of motion to a frame of reference, fixed stars, the equivalence of matter and energy, physics as geometry, the non-existence of the ether, the importance of creative imagination rather than mere fact-gathering, antimatter, a fourth dimension, wrinkles in space, molecular relative position and motion, and the motion of corpuscles as relative motion in a field. So lots of scientific constants there that were actually originally thought up by Pearson and that Einstein popularized. Pearson asserted that the laws of nature are relative to the perceptive ability of the observer, and the irreversibility of natural processes is a purely relative conception. For instance, an observer who travels at the exact velocity of light would see an eternal now or an absence of motion. He speculated that an observer who traveled faster than light would see time reversal, similar to a cinema film being run backwards. And his relativity was based on idealism in the sense of ideas or pictures within the mind. There are many signs, he wrote, that a sound idealism is surely replacing, as a basis for natural philosophy, the crude materialism of the older physicists. And he stated that in the preface to the second edition of The Grammar of Science. And he further stated, science is in reality a classification and analysis of the contents of the mind. In truth, the field of science is much more about consciousness than it is an external world. Law, in the scientific sense, is thus essentially a product of the human mind and has no meaning apart from man. So he's getting into some really metaphysical concepts there, even though, I mean, he's talking about science, but he's crossing over into religious fields here. And this was when science was at its best, I think, around about this time, rather than now. What are your thoughts on all of this, Max?
Well, yeah, I think that when you study the nature of matter, when you study the extremities of the universe, etc., then science does butt up against, and people have traditionally said that science butts up against religion, and that there are some sort of aspects of religion that can be derived from science and vice versa. But certainly you end up with some very deep philosophical and metaphysical issues there about you know, the purpose of life, the part we play in it, and where we're going, how we got where we are, all these kind of questions. Many of these questions are questions that science can't actually answer, and so it therefore becomes a matter of how you visualize these things in your own mind as to what you believe. And so, for example, you know, people think about the origin of life, the origin of the universe, and they think about the Big Bang theory, and I think there is lots of evidence to support the Big Bang theory. But then the question that you then ask is, well, what came before the Big Bang? Because you know that's exactly the same question as people who believe in religion, where they talk about how God has existed for millions and millions of years and for throughout eternity. But you then come up with a question, yeah, but what existed before God? How did God come about? You know, God may have existed for a long period of time, but how did God come about? And it's the same with the Big Bang. Okay, if science tells us that the universe was created by the Big Bang, well, what came before the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? And it is the same question, one being a scientific question, the other one being a question of religion.
And you got the fact that he was the guy to think up relativity, and it was Einstein that popularized that. And when do you actually hear about Carl Pearson involved with it? You don't. You just hear about Albert Einstein. I mean, it's this was news to me that it was a British guy that came up with these ideas. Well, Pearson was a eugenicist who applied his social Darwinism to entire nations, seeing a war against inferior races as a logical implication of the theory of evolution. My view, and I think it may be called the scientific view of a nation, he wrote, is that of an organized whole, kept up to a high pitch of internal efficiency by ensuring that its numbers are substantially recruited from the better stocks and kept up to a high pitch of external efficiency by contest, chiefly by way of war with inferior races. He reasoned that if August Weismann's theory of germplasm is correct, the nation is wasting money when it tries to improve people who come from poor stock. And I'll just stop there before we get into this theory of germplasm. And people may look at what he said there about a war against inferior races as, this is terrible, this is racism. But when you think about war itself, it drives us on because we need to provide defences for ourselves. We need to defend ourselves against attackers from the outside. And it's that in itself that drives science, that drives progress. It is essentially down to defence. And you have to look at the outsiders as, you know, being a threat in some kind of way. And that is what has driven progress for all of these years. And I think that plays into this as well. And then you've got the competition. I mean, you've got competition between individuals and it's survival of the fittest. And then you've got competition between the races and it's survival of the fittest. And I think this is more of what he was talking about, rather than one race is superior and the other race is inferior. Because if you defeat the other race on that level at war, then they were inferior at making war, basically, weren't they? It's not that he's saying that one race is better than the other. He's saying that we have to have this competition to provide improvement. And obviously our complaint today about multiculturalism is that this is all going on within one nation. You have these competing groups within one country, as it were, rather than these groups competing as separate countries and separate nations and competing together to get the best out of one another. Instead of that, we have that actually going on within our country's borders. We have these groups competing against one another. So maybe the way that he put it back then may have been seen as racist, but he's basically just explaining the way that the world works, I think.
But quite often in popular sources like Wikipedia, etc., you'll find that quotations made by people like Carl Pearson will be taken out of context and deliberately done that way in order to make it easier to demonize the person. I think that the quotation that you read out is from a speech that Pearson made, which is called National Life from the Standpoint of Science. I think he made that speech about 1914, something of that sort. And the one of my favorite quotations from that speech, which I think pretty much fits with what you're talking about there, is it goes like this: "This dependence of progress on the survival of the fitter race gives mankind's existence its one most redeeming feature, that it is the fiery crucible out of which comes the finer metal." And so he is viewing the competition between nations as being a process of evolution that will prove which will create the an ever increasing improvement in the human condition, effectively.
You have to have you have to have competition to bring out the to bring out the best in people. But as I was mentioning there, he reasoned that if August Weismann's theory of germplasm is correct, then the nation is wasting money when it tries to improve people who come from poor stock. And this theory of germplasm, that was actually proved correct, states that heritable information is transmitted only by germ cells in the gonads, which means the ovaries and the testes, not by somatic cells, which are the other cells of the body. And this idea is related to the idea that information cannot pass from somatic cells to the germline, which is contrary to Lamarckism, which is another theory, and this is called the Weismann barrier. And to some extent, this theory anticipated the development of modern genetics. In the germplasm theory, inheritance in a multicellular organism only takes place by means of the germ cells, the gametes, such as egg cells and sperm cells. Other cells of the body do not function as agents of heredity. The effect of this is one way. Germ cells produce somatic cells and more germ cells, but the germ cells are not affected by anything that the somatic cells learn or any ability that the body acquires during its life. Genetic information cannot pass from soma to germplasm and then on to the next generation. This is the Weismann barrier. This idea rules out the inheritance of acquired characteristics, meaning that training benefits only the trained generation. Their children would not exhibit the learned improvements, and in turn, they themselves will need to be improved. And there's a quote here: "No degenerate and feeble stock will ever be converted into healthy and sound stock by the accumulated effects of education, good laws, and sanitary surroundings. Such means may render the individual members of a stock passable, if not strong, members of society, but the same process will then have to be gone through again and again and again with their offspring, and this in ever widening circles. If the stock, owing to the conditions in which society has placed it, is able to increase its numbers." And that's just a basic scientific fact. If you have a people that only have a certain capacity to learn, and you teach them as much as you can and you bring them right to the limit of that capacity, the next generation is not going to increase its capacity. It is just going to stay at that capacity. You're not going to be able to fill more liquid into the glass. It can only contain a certain amount. And so what that means is, as much as you teach people, as much as you educate people, as much as you give them these good laws, you're just going to have to do it all over again with the next generation. So if you have peoples that have a low average IQ, you're not going to be able to raise them up to having a high average IQ, because that is a heritable characteristic. As we pointed out here, he inherited his intelligence from his parents, and he passed that intelligence on to his children, that very high intelligence, so that they were extremely successful. And that's why he was able to do all of this. If he had been low intelligence, he would have been able to learn some things, but then the next generation, they would have, of his children, they would have had to teach them and work as hard as they could all over again. It's maybe I'm not explaining it that well here, but it's basically, go on, Max, maybe you can explain it better.
Yeah, there was a there was a, I think it was a French scientist called Lamarck, who came up with the idea that a giraffe, for example, has got a long neck because the giraffe repeatedly stretches its neck in order to reach the leaves that are higher and higher on the tree. And so therefore, as a result of stretching, it then causes the animal's shape to actually change in doing that, and that this is where, for example, the somatic cells adapt to the environment in which the creature is living, and so it's the somatic cells that create the adaption, and that they, as a result of the adaption in the somatic cells, that is then passed on into the gene cells of the animal, i.e., its sperm or its egg, that will then be passed on to future generations, and so this is how, over a period of time, giraffes, for example, obtain their long neck. Now, that was then disproven in the vast majority of cases by the work of people like Galton, Darwin, and Pearson. And what they then established was that it is the genetic information that's passed on in the sperm and the egg that actually enables change to take place. And the change takes place as a result of individuals who've got certain capabilities either being adversely disadvantaged during their life as a result of those characteristics and therefore having fewer opportunities to reproduce, and those individuals who have characteristics that enable them to be particularly successful in that same environment having the ability to be more successful during their life and therefore being able to produce more offspring that carry the same characteristics. So it's the selective pressure that sorts out whose germ cells are going to produce the next generation. So therefore it is the chance mutations of genes within the germ cells that creates the differences, and that is the process of evolution that Darwin advocated. To some extent, that can still be questioned, though. As a general rule, what you said is absolutely correct with regard to heredity, etc. But in certain cases, for example, there is still research going on with regard to songbirds, for example, because you can take the egg that's been fertilized of a songbird, and you can put it in an incubator, and you can raise, keep it warm until eventually the egg hatches out, and until the bird that has hatched out reaches maturity. But that bird, even though it may be kept in a soundproof chamber and will have never heard the song that its parents sung, can still sing the song that its parents sung. And so there is, to some extent, something which is investigation goes on into, which is termed genetic memory, and there have been some more recent tests that have been done where generations of mice had been subjected to pain at the point where they eat. So they'll be offered food, and at the point where they eat, they'll have like perhaps electrodes attached to them, which will give them an electric shock, so that they then develop an aversion to starting to eat. What's then happened is that in future generations of these mice, it can still be measured that there is still a measurable extent of heightened anxiety when the animals go to eat, the offspring of the animals that were given the pain through electric shock. And so again, this is possibly another example of inherited memory, but inherited memory doesn't exist to the extent that it will enable a weak and a feeble individual to produce on average a strong and powerful child, or an individual lacking in intelligence to produce a child that is of very high intelligence.
Well, I think we can also see with this germplasm theory, I think we can see with civilization as well. And this is why you have one race that builds civilizations and can always do that and has done that throughout history. And you have other races that have lived alongside the race that built the civilizations and they've been taught how to do it for themselves. But then when the race that does build the civilization is no longer there, the civilization falls apart because the other race that was there didn't have that ability in the first place. They'd been taught how to maintain it, but they didn't have the ability to create one in the first place. And that's why you see all these ruins of civilizations around us, is because the people that built the civilization are no longer there. They lost their ethnic integrity, the integrity of the nation. They ended up interbreeding with the other race that was there that didn't build the civilization, and they're no longer able to do it. Even though they've been taught how to do it, they end up forgetting how to do it because it doesn't come naturally to them, because what they learned during their lives of how to maintain it did not get passed on through their germplasm. But with the race that actually did create the civilization, they do pass it on through their germplasm. And that's why we have the birth of all these different civilizations throughout our history. Thank you very much for listening, and do tune in again tomorrow for part 2 in our mini-series on Carl Pearson.